I'm welcoming into the studio best-selling writer Kate Morton to talk about her latest great big sweeping novel called The Secret Keeper. Last night at the National Library, the tradition of queuing for treasures was well and truly alive and well, with a big snaking circular queue with Canberrans wanting their book signed by the very friendly Kate. Kate's books are now published in 39 countries and in 26 different languages. And I think at last count, the sales of her first three books, The Shifting Fog, The Forgotten Garden and The Distant Hours, stand at 7.5 million and rising. This one, I think, is really going to take it through the 10 million barrier. I've got no doubt about that. And Kate has welcomed some 666 listeners here today. So we welcome you all. They're sitting in the green room waving to us all. And they're going to spend some special time with Kate Morton after this interview. So thanks, Kate Morton, for coming in and being so generous and to our listeners as well.
Alex, it's an absolute pleasure, and I have to say the girl crush is mutual.
it's beautiful. How long were you there signing books last night at the National Library?
Quite a long time, but I love it. I mean, writing is such a solitary occupation that to be able to go out and meet the people who take on my stories and bring them back to life in their imaginations is a wonderful thing, and I'm always grateful when people turn up for any event.
Well, you're so up for it and generous, and your publisher has told you that you have...
I have the nicest readers of any writer he's ever been on tour with. So there you go. I always suspected it, and now it is official and confirmed.
And he's not just saying that.
Definitely not.
But it must be because touring, you've done the UK tour, because of course The Secret Keeper is mainly set in the United Kingdom. So of course it was the obvious place to launch it. But is it exhausting?
It is. I love it though. As I say, meeting readers is wonderful. The most exhausting is the US tour, because they have quite a grueling schedule where it's a different city every day for authors, and that's quite a normal thing over there. But once again, you know, people always say to me, do you notice any differences in different nationalities, you know, when you meet your readers? And one of the most surprising and interesting things for me is that I don't, that my readers, they're all lovely people, they're book lovers, and I find that very buoying to think that all around the world there are like-minded people who just enjoy disappearing inside the world of a story and letting it, you know, come to life in their imagination.
And if I can talk a little bit more about that, perhaps I might just put that thought on hold.
Sure.
But for people who may be just hearing about Kate Morton for the first time, do you mind just doing a little bit of your background? So you grew up the eldest of three girls, and your family moved a lot of times when you were a child, 9 times, is
yes,
that right?
Yes, about that. At last count, it all gets a bit hazy because it all happened before I was 5 years old. I was born in South Australia in Berry, where the orange juice comes from, and then we moved through rural New South Wales until we landed finally on Tambourine Mountain, which is a small community up in the mountains of southeast Queensland, a very, very beautiful, almost magical place. And I was 5, so ready to start school, and that's where we stayed. Apparently my dad was offered a job, and it was there or Papua New Guinea. So, you know, who knows, sliding doors. Yeah. Life might have turned out very differently, but they chose Tambourine.
And, of course, one of the main characters in this book, Vivian Jenkins, comes, this is where she's born and spends a small time as a child.
Yes, that's right. And it was such a wonderful experience to be able to put some of my own childhood into my books because, you know, as you mentioned, the large part of my books is set in England, in the English countryside or in London. But the older I get, the more imperative it feels, the more pressing the need is for me to write about my own experiences. And so being able to try and trap those experiences into concrete sentences on the page and describe Tambourine Mountain for readers who may have been there or may not have been there was a wonderful thing.
You, Kate Morton is my guest this morning. You did your first degree in English at the University of Queensland, but you did think perhaps acting would be...
I did, yes. When I was growing up on the mountain, one of the few activities available for kids to do outside school were drama lessons, and that was by pure virtue of the fact that there were people who lived up there who were able to teach drama. So I had into my life came a pair of amazing people, Herbert and Rita Davies. She'd been a repertory actress on the London stages, and he'd been the head of drama for the Welsh BBC. And they'd come by way of South Australia to Tambourine, as many expats do, because at its altitude, it's just that bit cooler than Brisbane and the flatter parts of southeast Queensland. And they had a little tiny drama studio out of the garage where their cottage was nestled into the side of the rainforest. And I would go there for drama lessons. And when I first met them, I think I was 10 and Herbert was 70. But over the years, as I grew up, they progressed from being my teachers to being my great friends and mentors.
Do you think that's influenced your accent? Because you're very well spoken.
Perhaps. My whole family sound the same and I don't know why that is. But, you know, we all have similar mannerisms and similar voices. But, yeah, I'd say years and years of speech and drama lessons with English and Welsh, I have to say, teachers probably had an influence.
You did head off to RADA, which is the Royal Academy for Dramatic Arts,
yes.
Because you had your view. You had one view in mind, didn't you?
Yes, I wanted to be a member of the Royal Shakespeare Company. That was it, you know, not very flexible in my ambitions as an actress. And that would have been wonderful. But unfortunately for me, I lived in Brisbane and that made it a little difficult to be a member of a theatre troupe that was on the other side of the world. So I applied for a course at the Royal Academy of Dramatic Art, which is just around the corner from Bloomsbury. And I got to spend the most incredible English summer, you know, sort of treading off each day up the stairs, filing into these hallowed halls and letting myself be completely soaked in the world of Shakespeare, and just the pleasure of speaking those meaty, rich, beautiful lines was just incredible.
So you had this all going on, then the offer of a scholarship. It must have been a bit of a toss-up, was it?
It was, yes, because while I was there, a letter came through from the University of Queensland, where I had done my honours degree in English literature, offering me a scholarship to take up my master's. And, you know, my husband, who was my boyfriend at the time, we were very impoverished, you might say. And so this, although it was quite a modest amount, this tax-free scholarship just seemed like absolute riches. And I thought, they want to give me money to read books and write about them? How is this even possible? And so we went back home. He was in a band, so he was very happy to do that. And I took up the scholarship and started writing about tragedy in Victorian novels.
Actually, a writer friend, when she heard I was coming to talk to you last night, she went, you know, woman in her mid-30s, two children, best-selling writer. Has she struggled? I want to know, has she struggled? And you?
Definitely. I mean, who among us hasn't?
There you are, writer friend. Which brings me to The Secret Keeper. Now, it has the most wonderful opening. And if I can just set up, is that okay? I'm not going to give away any of the secrets because this book...
And there are so many secrets.
It does. It takes you, it just rolls, you're going, oh, it's a mystery, it's a detective story, and it just grabs you. But the opener is a restless 16-year-old who's in a treehouse looking down on the family. Now, the family is living in Suffolk?
In rural Suffolk, yes, a beautiful farm. It's the 1960s.
And for birthdays, they've gone down for a birthday thing by the stream. The mother has come up to get the special birthday cutting knife, which has a ribbon on it, birthday cake cutting knife. And the 16-year-old is up there going, I just want to be out of here. I want to go and be an actress. And she sees her mother come in with a little baby in her arms and then come out with the knife in her hand, with the ribbon around the knife, and a stranger comes down the path.
Yes.
And
something happens.
You don't want me to say
no.
Anymore. All right, say no more.
But something shocking happens.
So right from the start, this then provides Kate Morton with this incredible vehicle to explore this shocking event from different generations.
Yes, and that was so much fun. The first chapter, I from the very beginning, I wanted it to read almost like a separate little vignette, you know, a story on its own. And I had so much fun taking it from this beginning, which is rural and idyllic, this beautiful summer's day in 1961 England, sort of at that moment before the swinging 60s kicked into gear, when life was still quite staid. But through having this 16-year-old character, I was able to hint at, you know, the frustrations and the changes that were coming. And throughout the course of the chapter, things change dramatically, you know, because she looks through that treehouse window and she witnesses an absolutely shocking event. end chapter one, start on with the rest of the book. And then we meet her as a woman in her 60s in the present day who's made good on her ambitions to become an actress.
Well, she's won an Oscar. She has a character.
Indeed.
I started to cast Judi Dench, of course, in the role.
Well, I shouldn't say it, but I sometimes cast Judi Dench in the role too. And I'm very happy if Judi Dench is cast in the role.
You were saying it could be Helen Mirren, it could be Maggie Smith, you know.
Any of the dames, I'm not fussy.
So, yeah.
She's a successful, wonderful Oscar-winning actress, much loved, but a fun character because she's a little bit brittle as well, and they're my favourite types of characters and people, indeed. And she goes back to the family home from London because her, by now, very elderly mother is unwell, and Laurel, who is our actress character, realises that although the event she witnessed was explained almost satisfactorily, this is her last opportunity to really find out the truth of what happened that day and why. And it's a doozy of a secret, so, you know, it is very important
that
she does that. That
her mother could die with those secrets.
Exactly, yes. Family secrets. I can't get enough of them.
Well, can we? I mean, they are the stuff, I think, of so many. And I did put this book down at one stage and go, Daphne du Maurier, Rebecca.
Well, that is a huge compliment because I adore Daphne du Maurier, and Rebecca is just one of my favourite books. I mean, I love the idea that people in the present can be haunted metaphorically by events or people from the past, and Rebecca is the perfect example of that. I mean, the first Mrs. de Winter is right through that book, even though we never meet her as a character.
This takes us back to then the mother when she's in wartime London in the Blitz in 1941, and this sets up fantastic descriptions of London at that time. And I asked you last night, I said, how did you get that right? Because not that I was in London in 1941, but it just feels right.
Oh, I'm so glad because, you know, that's one of the things I love about my work as a writer is that I get to indulge my passion for various phases of history. And one of my favourite, one of the most intriguing to me, is that of Blitz time London. The war itself, of course, and you know, the battle front lines, but also life on the home front. And I had wanted to write about this period and set a book there for such a long time, but I held off because I suppose I was concerned that because it was so important to me, I would somehow do it a disservice and I'd, you know, render it thinly or turn it into a sort of false window dressing by just inserting a few bomb blasts and frightened people running through streets. And I didn't want to do that. So I set about, just for fun, doing some research when I was in London in 2008. I read as many books as I could find because, you know, that's one of my occupational hazards is I buy far too many books, particularly when I'm overseas and have to haul them back. But I read everything I could find and I visited the Imperial War Museum, but I still wanted more. So I looked on the internet and I found a fellow called Clive who was offering walking tours of Blitz time London. And I thought, well, this sounds exactly what I want. So I made contact and we agreed to meet on this, you know, at a particular place on Speaker's Corner. And he said I'd know him because he'd be wearing a red carnation in his lapel, which sounded lovely.
Meaning a man with a red carnation.
Yeah, exactly, which is why I quickly enlisted my sister and husband to come with me.
Very wise.
Just in case. But it turned out that they were unnecessary precautions because he was absolutely charming and a font of knowledge. And we spent the most wonderful, blustery, cold November London day walking through the streets of Mayfair. And I mean, you can glean so much of history from books, but there's something about living history, you know, being in the very streets where things happened, that to me is absolutely thrilling. And so, you know, to give you just one of many examples, we were walking down Upper Brook Street, away from the park. And Clive stopped and he pointed up at the wall of one of those beautiful brick Edwardian buildings, you know, with the white painted brick. And he said, have a look over there. And I looked, and above the external staircase on the side of the wall, suddenly I could see plain as day, I don't know why I'd never seen it before, the ghost of a black painted S and an arrow pointing down the stairs. And he said, well, that's a shelter sign. And, you know, there it was. No perspex covering it, no label, just sitting there in the middle of the present day street. And for me, as a writer, but as a person too, when I see something like that, suddenly I can imagine the frightened people rushing through the streets and children being shepherded down the stairs and searchlights in the distance and the sort of wail of the air raid siren and the thrum of planes getting closer. And you can almost smell the fear of what it must have been like in those streets. And, you know, so for me, a whole afternoon of that kind of thing was such an inspiration.
Kate Morton is with me, and her latest book is called The Secret Keeper. He also pointed out, could you tell that story?
I love that. I mean, I just love these, the tidbits from Clive. When we were in Speaker's Corner, when I first met him, the very first thing he did was point up at one of the black metal lamp posts, you know, that sort of looked like the one that you'd find through the wardrobe if you were going into Narnia. And he pointed up and it was bent at the top. And he said, there's only one thing that can bend metal like that, and it's heat. Whenever you see that, you know that a bomb dropped nearby. And this is something I took away, and it's become something of an obsession for me when I'm in London to find these lamp posts. And in fact, I was there a month ago, and right where I was staying, there was one across the road. And, you know, my children and I now look for them everywhere. And if you see them, whichever direction they're bent in, if you look the other way behind you, you will see a contemporary building between old ones. And, you know, that's where
the bomb hit.
And, you know, that just gives me such a shiver to think that you're sort of bearing witness to the place of, you know, somebody's horror.
The other great character in this book is Jimmy, that allows you to tell the story, because Jimmy's a war photographer and he is a love interest, of course, in this book.
Of course.
Allows you to again create those pictures, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. And part of what I saw at the Imperial War Museum that inspired me, even though I didn't know that I was going to use it in a book called The Secret Keeper at the time, there was a special exhibition on of photographs taken during the war. And they were so moving. And it really got me thinking, when I started writing, it just seemed such an obvious thing to make my character, Jimmy, a war photographer. And photos play a very important part throughout the entire book. Because as a person, they've always struck me as these little pieces of the past, you know, just a moment, a white hot moment frozen into two dimensions that we're able to carry forward with us, and, you know, for posterity's sake. And having Jimmy allowed me to illustrate some of those moments, but also to explore his own anxieties about the ethics of taking a photo like that. I mean, it's important for history's sake that we have those, but at the time, it's somebody's horror that you are trapping on photographic paper. You know, and that was a very meaningful thing for me to write about.
He's a beautiful character, Jimmy.
Oh,
and in fact, he was ordered up by your husband.
He certainly was. My husband was unimpressed because he said, you know, you do all right with the female characters, but, you know, all the men in your books, they're really, really awful, or really, really awful things happen to them. And I said, righto, my friend, book number four, what can I do?
There is a very awful man in this, but there I won't reveal that.
And not our Jimmy. He's a lovely man.
There's so many characters, but we're running out of time. It's 24 past 10, and Kate Morton is my guest this morning, and we're talking about her fantastic new book that you can't put down called The Secret Keeper. And I was talking to you about your childhood before, and there's a beautiful passage, and when I put this down, I thought, this is about Kate Morton herself. And Katie Ellis, who has accompanied little Vivian, who comes on the ship to England from Tambourine Mountain, when Vivian was a child, and Katie writes, she's about Vivian, she says, I know Vivian, and I know how deeply she believes. One of the things I've come to know most surely in my work is that the belief system acquired in childhood is never fully escaped. It may submerge itself for a while, but it always returns in times of need to lay claim to the soul it shaped.
Yes. Yeah, and you're absolutely right. And that is one of the rewarding things about being a writer, is getting to trap into words some of those thoughts and feelings that we have as people. And that is one that I share with
the story you told about your mother and going to antique shops as children. Oh. And I said, did she find a white fluffy coat in that?
She certainly found a lot of strange costumes for us, because my mum is an antiques dealer. And so we spent a large part of our childhood, far larger than we would have liked at the time, trawling through dark, dusty, dim secondhand shops, hunting up treasures. But, you know, as you point out, that I look back and I didn't enjoy that at the time, but it absolutely shaped the person I am now, the things I'm interested in, my obsession and interest in the past, my awareness that old objects have passed through many hands to get to us. And, you know, like Katie Ellis says, I look back at my own childhood and I'm very much still that small child growing up in the sort of sunny mountaintops.
Reading Enid Blyton.
Reading Enid Blyton. And you know what? I always climb trees to read books. I always hid to read, and the best place, because it's a proven fact, scientifically proven fact, people rarely look above themselves. So the best place to hide, if you ever need to know, is up above people's eye line. So I used to climb avocado trees and find myself a lovely bough in the shade, and I would take my books up with me and read.
So no treehouse for you?
I didn't have a proper treehouse, but I had a lot of trees, so I shouldn't complain.
Do you have a loft now you can go to?
I don't know, but we did. When I was on Tambourine, the house that I remember growing up in was right on the edge of the rainforest, and we would frequently slip down to the creek and the waterfall and go rock hopping, we called it, and collecting tadpoles and trying to sell them to unsuspecting drivers on the road. But that house did have a loft, and we were so lucky because that was our bedroom, you know.
Last night there was a great question. You had a terrific crowd last night, and you've got a terrific crowd here today. And Kate's coming to talk to you very soon. But there was a question a lot of people really wanted, given your incredible success, about the rules of writing. What kind of rules? And you said, actually,
the only rule I ever follow is that you should write what you love. People always say write what you know, but I think that's what research is for. To my mind, as a reader and as a writer, you can always tell when a writer's heart and soul is in the pages of their books. And so that's my guiding principle, is to, if I'm not loving it, I stop for a while and I work out what's wrong with it, and then I go back and I just fill it with everything that thrills and excites me.
In fact, you say your first manuscripts were according to the rules?
They were, because I was starting out and I read all the how to write books, and I looked at books that were selling in bookstores, and I sort of deconstructed them and I tried to model my own efforts on them, and they, you know, I managed to finish manuscripts and they held together, but there was no magic in them, and there was nothing that made a publisher say, yes, this speaks to me and I want to put that out as a book. And it wasn't until I'd come to terms with the fact that I'd never be a published writer and I was just going to write for the sheer love of it, that I relaxed and put everything I love into my work, and lo and behold, that was The Shifting Fog, and it's the one that got picked up.
And Kate Morton, you also in that answer too talked about the characters that you develop, and you've had the girl in the treehouse for a while, haven't you?
I have, probably since I was that girl climbing up, you know, to read books. But yeah, I carried her around with me, this image of this girl in a tree who sees something she shouldn't, and I tried to force her into other books. And you know, it's such a strange thing, because you know, I don't believe that characters take over. I refuse to let them do that, and yet I tried to write her and trap her in other books, but she always ejected herself because she just didn't belong in those stories. And it wasn't until I was coming up with the idea for Secret Keeper that I finally realised who she was and what it was that she'd seen.
The other fascinating thing you talked about last night is your English editor, in terms of making sure that you've got all the details right about English history.
Absolutely. I'm really blessed because I have a fantastic editorial team here in Australia through Allen and Unwin, but I also have English editors, which is really useful when the large part of my book is set in England, because there are certain things that an Australian, no matter how much research I undertake, I just will never know all of the little nitty-gritty details. And, you know, I've had things like, oh, you couldn't possibly have a third story on that house. It's Suffolk, and they just don't have three-story houses there. And things like stairs are inside buildings and steps are outside buildings. And I just find that such an, you know, I'm a word person, so I love adding those little details to my own knowledge of the English language.
Kate Morton, it's been a thrill to have you, and I will now let you go to our gorgeous listeners. Thank you, everyone, for coming in. I'll continue here, but you get to spend time with Kate Morton, all of you.
Thank you, Alex.
And I think there's a cup of tea and perhaps even a chocolate biscuit. We may have upgraded because of Kate's status. But thank you, Kate. Congratulations on the book, and I can't wait for the next one, which I know you're already writing.
I'm already working on it. Yeah. Thank you so much. It's been a real pleasure.
It's lovely to meet you. Thanks.